The headline of this week's national interest is, does India matter? And this at the precise moment or during the precise hours when Prime Minister Narendra Modi is in the US meeting Joe Biden after having met Kamala Harris and his other Quad counterparts. This is by far the most important foreign visit he has made, and these are by far the most important meetings he has had with his global interlocutors. At a time like that, we ask a question in this column, does India matter? So this might draw one of two responses from you. One can be, Shekhar Gupta dimag kharab hua hai, are you nuts? Go get your head examined. How can you even raise the question, does India matter or not? Or the second response can be, we know what your intention is. You're just trying to be provocative for the heck of it. This is just clickbait. So here is my response. First of all, indeed, I will be nuts if I said India doesn't matter. Or if I answered in the negative to the headline question that I have raised or the question that I've made into my headline. I'm not mad. India, of course, does matter. And I can take half an hour explaining why it doesn't. You will know all of that. So I'm not going to do that. The second charge I am guilty to, that I am being provocative. And I need to be provocative, because why? Why India matters to the world? That is something that Narendra Modi, the master communicator himself, has explained quite pithily. He explained this in terms of 3 Ds. You know, he likes this alliterative phraseology. So what were the 3 Ds? Yaad kijiye aap, exam mein aayega kal ko, particularly if you're in UP, appearing in UPSC. The 3 Ds are democracy, demography, and demand. Very good argument, right? That India is a democracy worth emulating. India has this wonderful demography, young people all joining the workforce. India's dependency ratio, that is the number of people who are so old, they depend on the earnings of younger people. That is still very low and very robust. India's people are talented. That is demographics. And third is demand, because with this kind of demographics, as more and more people start earning, setting up houses, there is demand for things. So these 3 Ds, he said, make India an irresistible proposition to the entire world. Now, if I said I can put it even better than him, then again, you will laugh at me, because this is put very, very succinctly. So I will leave at that. But if we answer that question only in terms of this one bit of phraseology from Narendra Modi, 3 Ds, then what do we debate? The 4th D gets lost, which is essential to a democracy. So again, this is not a question. I'm not being provocative for the heck of it. I'm being provocative because I need to generate a debate. First of all, why does India matter? The Prime Minister has explained to you his 3 Ds. How much does India matter? How can India matter more? Those are the questions that we raise. And what are the things that India does from now on that will enhance India's irresistibility to the world and serve India's purpose, larger strategic purpose? Or what is it that India can do that will undermine it? That is the debate we are orchestrating with this column of national interest. That's why we must ask this question at this point and also provoke a debate, because this is at a time when India's global engagement, especially on the strategic side, is the strongest and the most decisive ever. I say most decisive ever, so ever begins after, say, the post-1971 phase when India signed that peace treaty of peace, friendship and cooperation with the Soviet Union. 89-90, as we know, the Soviet Union didn't survive. So that treaty did not survive and that phase ended. The fact is that a decade after that was India's decade of strategic isolation. Say from 1991 to 2001, India was in strategic isolation in the sense that nobody saw India as that important. India's traditional ally, India's strategic ally, because remember the Treaty of Peace, Friendship and Cooperation with the Soviet Union said that in case either country was under attack or had a threat to its security, the other would come to its aid. It didn't say militarily, but that was the implication. That was not there anymore. So for 10 years, India was searching some place in the strategic space in the world, and it did not matter so much. And then a lot changed after that. Now, I can go into detail of what happened after that. We know that 1999, Vajpayee government tested the nuclear weapons. This time it was the weapons, not peaceful nuclear explosion. 2001, more importantly, 9/11 happened. After 2001, after 9/11, in the same year, the attack on Parliament happened, and India then launched Op Parakram, and that brought in global attention to India, particularly of those who were then facing this humongous threat from pan-Islamic terrorism. And then that created this identification of India as a friendly victim of a common threat. Now, after that one decade of isolation, change came, and we have to thank four successive prime ministers for it. P.B. Narasimha Rao, who first made a shift. Remember, he normalized India's relations with Israel. He reached out to America. He reformed India's economy. So he began looking westwards. That was the first beginning. After that came Atal Bihari Vajpayee. Now, Narasimha Rao did it despite not having a majority. His was a minority government. Vajpayee did it, although his government, his innings was broken into three, one for 13 days, one for about a year, one for 4.5 years, right? So three prime ministerships, two very short, and even the third, not quite 5 years, but he picked up the baton from Narasimha Rao and carried this forward. And then Manmohan Singh, in his 10 years, strengthened it, and the big change that came in 2008-09 with the nuclear deal. Now, many critics of the nuclear deal then said, what is this nuclear deal? Because of this, no energy will come into India. And even now they say, see, we were right, not a megawatt of energy is coming to India because of the deal, nuclear energy, and not a megawatt is being built as a consequence of that deal. But people like us who supported the nuclear deal had always said that this is not about energy. This is about changing India's strategic positioning and shifting India's historic worldview on its national interest. And that is what these great prime ministers were able to do. Narendra Modi took it forward. He not only embraced the nuclear deal, whatever his party may have said in parliament, it voted against Manmohan Singh's government. It called it all kinds of things, including, if I remember correctly, Sushma Swaraj saying this is like Emperor Jahangir allowing the East India Company to come and trade in India, which led to India's colonization. But he's taken it forward and he's invested a lot in it. And now he's come to a moment which makes me hark back to Jawaharlal Nehru. And I know it can be triggering for some people if you quote Jawaharlal Nehru now. But, you know, I can do no better at this point than to borrow from his Tryst with Destiny speech and say that this is Narendra Modi's Tryst with Strategic Destiny. This is Narendra Modi's moment to redeem the Tryst with Destiny that Narasimha Rao made earlier in 1991 by beginning to reform India's economy. Because as Nehru said, a time comes, and I will now look at my screen because I can't afford to misquote Nehru because this is such a historically recorded statement. Nehru said, time has come to redeem it, even if not wholly or in full measure, but at least substantively. So that Tryst with Strategic Destiny that started with Narasimha Rao, that moment has now come when Narendra Modi can redeem it substantially. Will he do it? Can he do it? What are the issues here? That is what we are discussing. So let's go forward with this argument. Let's go back. Let's go forward by going backwards to Narendra Modi's famous line, famous 3D line. That is democracy, demography, and demand. At this point, demography and demand are both struggling. Demography is struggling. You can see this in our unemployment figures. Unemployment has been rising, not just in the last couple of years, but for the last 4 or 5 years. Our economic growth is not what it used to be. It's not as robust as before. And because too many jobs are being lost, new jobs are not being created, people's incomes are not rising, particularly at lower levels of income, MSMEs, self-employed people, that is the reason why demand is not picking up. Now, that is something even the government doesn't contest, because they say that they are trying very hard to increase demand in India, regenerate demand in India, but demand is poor. Now, you can blame those two on the pandemic, although India's economic stall started earlier, but you can blame this on the pandemic, and the world is also willing to be patient. The world is patient. The world will wait for India to get its act together on the economy, that is on demand and demographics. In any case, now there is a China aversion. A lot of global capital is looking for destinations other than China. So India will be in demand, even if India's own domestic demand is slackening a little bit. But it's the third element which is problematic, which is democracy. India's democracy today is seen globally to have weakened. Now, you may come up with arguments, counter-arguments. I know a lot of people will get angry because I say this. Now, before you start fighting with me, I would suggest you Google that statement that jointly Kamala Harris, the Vice President of America, and our Prime Minister Modi made in front of the media for cameras. So if you hear Kamala Harris's statement, and if you see the text, and if you see that statement with the eyes and ears of a sharp observer, and not a non-partisan observer, you don't have to be non-partisan. Watch it, read it, or hear it as a partisan observer. Partisan as in pro-India. We are all Indian partisans. If you look at that statement, it does look like the Vice President of America is actually delivering a public admonition to the Prime Minister of India. Now, first of all, we haven't seen any foreign leader say this to Narendra Modi or speak to Narendra Modi like this. She said nothing insulting or nothing. Everything she said was very sweetly worded. It was, to use an Americanism, it was dripping in maple syrup. But she made some very important and very interesting points, and these points amount to admonition. So what exactly did she say? I will once again look at the screen and read exactly what she said so I don't get anything wrong and thereby mix up any nuance. Kamala Harris said that as democracies around the world are under threat, quote, it is imperative that we defend democratic institutions and principles within our respective countries. So she's also telling Modi to do this in India. Now, that's where I said, oops, was it the Vice President of America giving a sermon to Prime Minister of India, who's not even her equal in protocol terms? Because the President would be Narendra Modi's equal, not the Vice President. So that's the reason I use the word oops with this, because this was an oops moment for Narendra Modi. Now, if Narendra Modi was taken aback, or if he was disappointed with this, he's too much of a Ghutawa Khiladi, too sharp a public figure to betray any emotion in front of the cameras. His own statement was all motherhood and apple pie, all platitudes, all fine. There was no response. Obviously, it was a good idea not to get into any tutu meme or say ke aap apne yahan dekho kya kar rahe ho, apne yahan dekho 6 January ko kya hua tha. See what happened in your country on 6th of January. America has a lot to answer. But this would not have been the time for an Indian leader, that to somebody who in protocol terms also is higher than his interlocutor at that point, to make that point. And I would say that Narendra Modi displayed quite remarkable, admirable diplomatic and strategic patience by not responding. But the fact is, he cannot miss the point that he had been given a little lecture by the Vice President of America of the kind that he hasn't heard before. In fact, somebody might say that when Barack Obama came to India for the Republic Day celebrations, on his way out, he gave a speech at Sri Fort Auditorium in Delhi to all kinds of people, civil society, etc., where he reminded India and Modi government, he didn't name the Modi government, but by implication of the need for religious tolerance, etc. But that was after the formal part of his visit was over, his meetings were over, and that was in any case not said in the presence of Narendra Modi. This time, Kamala Harris said this in the presence of Narendra Modi. So something has changed. What is it that has changed? This was the first time Modi had to hear such a message in public. And while he took it on the chin without wincing and moved on, which shows quite admirable diplomatic skills, the question that we raise is, would he now reflect on what brought him to this stage? What exposed this flank to him of him? To global leaders, particularly leaders of India's most important friends globally? That is the question that he has to ask, and that's the question we are reflecting on. Now, look at America. So I will first tell you what hasn't changed in America and what has changed between Trump, Pence, and Biden, Harris. I just list Pence there because I have to list Harris in this case. So Trump, Pence, and Biden, Harris. One thing that hasn't changed is the American strategic worldview. They both see China as the main threat now. They've both moved on from many other issues. They are not looking at Europe anymore. They are both continuing to focus on Asia. They see China as the biggest danger, the biggest threat and biggest challenge right now. In fact, if anything, Biden is even more forthright on his actions on China. He has been quite unambiguous in listing China as a threat or a challenge for the future. He also has moved at top speed to seal AUKUS with Australia and UK, which is nothing but an unabashed military alliance to contain China. That is a straight message. So he's done a lot more on China in carrying forward the same strategic policy as from Trump's times without actually writing those vain tweets and denying us all that entertainment. So in a sense, in substance, the policy hasn't changed. What has changed, on the other hand, is the US administration's view of democracy, democratic practices, and treatment of minorities, especially the Muslims. Now, it's the old Hindi heartland wisdom that you ask a starving person, what is 2 plus 2? Do jama do kya hota hai? He will say, char rotiyan, four rotis, because it's a starving person. Only thing he can think of is rotis. So you ask politicians, what is 2 plus 2? They will say four votes. So politicians work for their votes. Nations work in their own interest. Big nations only work in their own interest. Even if they do something good for somebody, it's in their own interest. That's why they become big, powerful nations. India, US, China, Russia, they are all like that. No exceptions, and nobody should judge anybody. At the same time, leaders also work in their political interest. And when the two things can converge, it's even better. So for the Democrats, that is the convergence that they now see in their commitment to democracy, democratization, and also treatment of minorities. Trump couldn't care less about India's treatment of Muslims because Muslims didn't vote for Trump and they were not going to vote for Trump. So how does it matter? On the other hand, for Biden, Harris, and going ahead for Harris and Democrats, Muslims vote for them in America and they will continue voting for them. They want them to continue voting for them. And they have strong pressure groups within their own party and their own voter base, which they cannot overlook or ignore. And that is something I would say I'll be very surprised if it's not adequately understood on Narendra Modi's side. That is why time has now come for Narendra Modi to reflect on his domestic politics. Is his domestic politics now running counter to India's larger strategic interest? Is there one thing in the Afghan debacle? In fact, if there is one thing in the Afghan debacle that we should learn, it is that the Western world now, the world by and large, but particularly Western world led by the US, has now pivoted away from the Islamic world. Definitely, it's pivoted away from Islamic terrorism being its preeminent threat. They've gotten over this. They now see, they've moved eastwards, they now see China as their preeminent threat, not the Islamic world. And this is something that the American thinker, American political scientist, Francis Fukuyama, has been saying for quite some time, that pan-Islamic terror has ceased to be the number one threat to the world. It is now this disruptive rise of China, and everybody has to think about it. Now, if that wasn't the reason, why would it be that Biden is not calling Imran Khan, despite all of Imran Khan's establishment going into apply, no reply kind of tizzy? That's because he doesn't see Pakistan as that important anymore. There is a misperception in India that this victory in Afghanistan, victory of the Taliban, has made Pakistan very powerful. It hasn't. It's actually weakened Pakistan and made it immaterial, because the Western world has moved away from Afghanistan. If anything, they've left Afghanistan in the guardianship of China, Russia, and by implication, Pakistan. Now, it's for them to make sure that there is no mischief done out of Afghanistan, because if it is done, then it is contrary also to China's and Russia's interest. And Pakistan cannot use that leverage. Pakistan has lost the Afghan leverage. Pakistan cannot say, oh, now Al-Qaeda will come up again. There'll be 9/11 again. Nobody will tolerate this anymore, not even China and Russia. So Pakistan at this moment has a very easy choice. Either they should reform their own internal polity and their own political contact and their own political conduct, particularly in the neighborhood, they cannot blackmail the world with Islamic terror, right? Or they can continue to live in splendid strategic isolation as a protectorate of the Chinese. So that's a choice the Pakistanis are left with. India, on the contrary, matters even more. And not because India is seen as a counter or as an ally against pan-Islamic terror, as might have been the case in 2001 and onwards for a few years. That story for now is over. India matters even more because it's seen as one strong, powerful, large country with robust armed forces and with the ability and with the guts to look the Chinese in the eye. Because that is the threat that the world faces right now. That is why India matters even more than before. Now, do you want to give it up? Do you want to lose it? You can call Freedom House or any of these think tanks or any of these democracy watchdogs what you like. You can call them American establishment lackeys. You can even call them CIA agents if that pleases you. But the fact is, when Freedom House downgrades India to a partial democracy, it hurts India's larger strategic interest. It damages the most important of those three Ds that matter for India. That is D for democracy. Because India goes to the world as a big, chaotic country, very diverse, but democratic. And the whole world, whole democratic world should be proud of India. All of India's partners in the Quad are democracies. No democracy is perfect. America's isn't, Australia's isn't, Japan's isn't, but they are democracies. There, even if only one democracy is now listed as a partial democracy, it is something that India can do without. Now, I'm not just getting fixated on that buzz ranking by Freedom House. I'm just using that as an example. That is where India's problem right now comes from. That India's, because it is when this D, that is democracy, gets undermined, that the Prime Minister, India's most powerful Prime Minister in more than 50 years, has to listen to a sermon by the Vice President of America in public. So, in conclusion, Narendra Modi has a historic opportunity to lead his country into a new, more secure strategic space to help India break out of this two-front triangulation, China on one side, Pakistan on the other, without an ally because India's only ally, the Soviet Union, ceased to exist. He has that historic opportunity to reset India strategically in the world. He can only do it with India as a full-fledged, robust democracy that sets an example to others, not one that gets lectured by others. He can grab this opportunity or he can blow it over a sort of compulsive, persistent domestic political temptations, compulsions, obsessions. You choose the adjective.